What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like JoJo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. Please rate and review the Katie Helper Show on iTunes. And also please become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/the Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/the Katie Helper Show. This episode this week is really jam-packed with great stuff. First, I interview Mondaire Jones, who won his primary in New York's 17th district. Then Nando Villa and I talk about corporate Dems and how much they suck. Then I play an interview I did with Chase Aboudin, the San Francisco DA, the decarceral San Francisco DA. And before I play my interview with Chase, I give you a sneak peek look at our Patreon-only episode for this week, which is an interview with Ali Abu Nima, who goes over the hypocrites who signed a notorious Harper's letter, followed by a debate between Ali Abu Nima and letter signer and historian and friend of the show, Matt Karp. We are live. I like this.
It's a 5, 4, 3.
And we're live at the Katie Helper Show. And I'm Katie Helper. And this is my co-host, my Montes, my Cervantes.
There you go. You know, Cervantes was a slave.
I know that. And he got ripped down.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that soon. He was a slave. I know.
Lost his hand in the Battle of Lepanto, which is the largest naval engagement. Yeah, that's why they call him El Manco de Lepanto.
Hold on one second. Did I say your name yet?
No.
Nando Villa. Okay, hey, Nando Villa. Now, please, hey, thank you so much. Please continue with this. I'm on the edge of my seat. There's
this mansplain of Cervantes.
Yeah, Spanish. It's okay. You're gringo-splaining me.
Yeah. So everyone knows Cervantes. He wrote Don Quixote. The guy who wrote Don Quixote was a slave for many years. He was captured by. He was basically in the Navy, and he was captured by Barbary pirates and was a slave in North Africa and for many years. And then he ended up fighting in a battle called the Battle of Lepanto, which was between Spain and the Ottoman Empire. And it was the largest naval engagement in human history. And he lost his hand in that battle. And then he wrote Don Quixote.
By the way, I didn't even announce who our guests are today. We got two, at least two guests. One of them is Mondaire Jones, who won his primary for New York's District 17. Please say that. I'm so bad at remembering the districts. Yes. Oh, we got our guests. Yes. Okay.
Nice.
All right. Are you guys ready to welcome our first guest?
Yes.
All right. Here we go. Hello.
What up?
How are you? Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to it.
Great. And this is my co-host, Nando Villa.
Hey, how's it going? Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
People always ask you about why you ran, right? But I actually wanted to start with a different question, which was, it was really moving watching your victory speech, or like your almost sure victory speech, unofficial victory, I guess, speech, that you cited Bayard Rustin.
And of course, the historic nature of this campaign is not lost on me. Growing up poor, black, and gay, I never imagined that somebody like me could run for Congress. Again, let alone be a leading contender for the nomination in the great New York 17th Congressional District. Had I been able to look to someone quite like myself, it would have been direct evidence of the fact that things really do get better later in life. And so this is for Barbara Jordan. That powerful voice in the United States House of Representatives who could not live an authentic life. This is for Bayard Rustin, the architect of the March on Washington, who could not publicly be associated with Martin Luther King because of the scandal of who he loved.
Bayard Rustin, underrated.
Very underrated, yes.
Very underrated.
Yeah, and I'm curious how you even, like, what his legacy means for you and how long you've known about him, because I feel like a lot of people didn't know about him until they were older or never had found out. But
it took an African-American history class in college for me to learn about Bayard Rustin. And, you know, he's this just tremendous figure in the civil rights movement who, as I mentioned, the night of what I'll now call my victory. I mean, I'm at a point where I'm ready to declare. I see it happening in a few days because I've been observing the counting of these absentee ballots, and we are at least maintaining our lead that we saw in the in-person voting. So, but in any event, so he's the architect of the March on Washington, and the guy can't even really take ownership of that publicly. Can't publicly really participate in the event because he's gay. And yeah. Martin Luther King, you know, it's at a time when society is not accepting of people who are gay. And despite the fact that so many more luminaries were, you know, when you look at the movement for civil rights in this country, especially for Black people, when you look at so many of the participants in the Harlem Renaissance, so many of your favorite writers and authors and you know, and so they could not, Barbara Jordan could not live a life as an openly gay Black woman, this powerful voice in the House of Representatives, who we had to find out in her obituary had lived with a woman for 20 years. So it's been a long time coming, and I'm really proud to be making history in the process of running for Congress.
And what did inspire you to run?
Yeah, because it must suck.
What must suck?
Running to for run? Yeah. Politics stuff.
You know, when you are running to represent a community that means a lot to you, and when you recognize how high the stakes are, it is a joy, and also it's not really tiring because you're just full of all this adrenaline. Like, I'm still not tired. You're running, and I was running longer than most of the people in my race because I dared to challenge the chair of the House Appropriations Committee on Monday, July 8th, right? Before it, 3 months later, it became an open seat. And everyone who had ever aspired to elected office moved back, largely to Chappaqua, it turns out, to throw their hat in the ring. And so it's been an incredible journey, one that I really appreciate. I was running for Congress and continue to run for Congress now as the presumptive Democratic nominee, because I think that we've got some really big challenges in this country, and we need structural changes in our society, including in our economy, in our healthcare system, and the way that we fund public schools. And I happen to be a proponent of tuition-free public colleges and universities, so that we don't take on crippling student debt as young people in society. And so we need big structural solutions to meet those challenges. And for me, this is all very personal. I grew up in Section 8 housing and on food stamps. My young single mom still had to work multiple jobs just to put food on the table for us. So when we talk about things like a $15 minimum wage, I mean, that's something I know to be a need from my firsthand experience. And of course, she got help raising me from my grandparents. My grandfather was a janitor, and my grandmother cleaned homes, and when daycare was too expensive, she took me to work with her. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about the need for universal child care in this country, that is a fight that I want to join when I get to Washington, because I don't want a kid to have to go through what I went through when I was growing up.
Yeah. You come from a progressive, politicized family. Was that your own journey?
You know, I don't come from a political family, period. You know, I'm grateful to my grandfather for getting me involved in the NAACP, but that was really the extent. We weren't members. Mm. You know, he wasn't on the local Democratic committee or anything like that. And so for me, it was the activism as a member of the NAACP as a young person, and also I think feeling a sense of urgency about any number of issues impacting my generation that maybe people who have been on, you know, on this planet for a longer time, you know, can't quite relate to, right? Whether it's the student debt crisis or climate catastrophe, which, you know, dealing with that is my number one priority, because I actually have a stake in the future of the planet, I think. Right. It's probably why I care more about it than some other people in Congress. Healthcare is something that I think is a human right, especially in the richest nation in the history of the world. And I don't just say that to be saying it. I actually support Medicare for all, unlike the other people in my crowded Democratic primary, and unlike, unfortunately, you know, people right now who are running for higher office than that. So we need to be encouraging people as well to move to catch up with public opinion, because now a majority of the American people support Medicare for all.
Right. And so was your family an activist family? Did they talk about racism, civil rights?
My grandparents were from Jim Crow, Virginia, right? They moved when they were of age, they moved up to New York. You know, my grandfather, I vividly remember telling me a story of how when he was walking to school in the South, because he had to walk a dirt path as white children rode by in a school bus, they would spit on him through the window. And so, you know, he shared stories like that and other stories. So did my grandmother of discrimination. And so we always cared about racial injustice in this country. And we knew that it was a problem. You know, it's our lived experiences and nothing else. And, you know, he was an active member of the NAACP, the local NAACP chapter. Shout out to the Spring Valley NAACP. I became involved in the youth council and reactivated the youth council. And the rest is really, really history. I mean, we are, you know, a conscious family, I'll say.
Right.
My dad was actually more liberal than my mom, which tends not to be the case in our politics. You know, women tend to be more progressive than men on average.
Right.
But, you know, but of course I didn't grow up with my dad. So, you know, only in my adulthood that I've reconnected with.
I also heard you share a story about how you, something that helped you come out was music and the show Noah's Ark.
Yes.
And I gotta say, I on this show and a lot of the people that I talk to politically, we spend a lot of time like challenging the way that representation is used as a cudgel to actually stop like progressive policies and politics that actually empower everyone and disproportionately empower LGBTQ people, people of color. So I have to say, this sounds silly, but this is why. And I've always said representation is important. Like representation is important. You just can't stop there.
Right.
You can't use that. But it was really moving. Like, can you tell me what that process was like? Like what it was that, how it helped out? If this is not too personal a question.
No, it's not too personal. You can ask me literally anything. And I think we need more transparency in our elected officials and people vying for those seats. Let me start by saying that I agree with you. I do think it's used as a cudgel. And just today I was complaining about how, you know, so many of the people saying that we need to vote for someone, you know, who looks a certain, you know, who looks a certain way, right? So many of the Black people who I see in office right now do not represent me as well as some of the white people who I would support in an election, who are championing, you know, substantive policies that would actually improve the lives of Black Americans, LGBTQ plus Americans like myself, and of course the American people writ large.
You know, Bernie Sanders called me a few days ago. That was an amen. And I was grateful to have that conversation with him. And what I said to him was, Senator Sanders, people were hurting, young people in particular were hurting over the results of the presidential primary on the Democratic side. But I am enormously grateful to them for channeling that energy, that hurt, that pain, into down ballot races like mine to build a bench of progressive leaders who can continue the movement of making sure that everybody in this country can live in dignity.
And so for me, to your point, it cannot be the end of the analysis. You know, just to get, you know, a person of color or a woman or a member of the LGBTQ plus community in office. Having said that, there is power in representation. My goodness, You probably heard this if you listen to some of the things that I've said before. But growing up poor, black, and gay, I never imagined that someone like myself could run for United States Congress, let alone win such a seat. And for the vast majority of my life, including as recently as 5 years ago, I did not think that I could run for office as an openly gay candidate. And so for that reason, you know, planned on not doing such a thing. I didn't think that society would be accepting of me. I would have to always hide who I was, which I was unwilling to do as well.
Right.
It's wild to me now that I'm one of the most openly gay people in America in politics.
Right.
And look, it's pretty cool in the sense that I get so many messages that energize me and that remind me of why I'm doing this, from people young and old who are queer. Many of them are queer people of color who are saying, you have helped me come to terms with my own identity, live an authentic life. And you know what? I'll take it. You know, in a world where LGBTQ youth disproportionately experience thoughts of suicide, I will gladly run to inspire people to be who they are. Now, of course, that's not why I'm running. You know, I mean, it's a wonderful byproduct of it.
Right.
I'm running to be a champion for the working people in my district, recognizing that government has never worked for everyone. It's only ever worked for a subset of the American people. But you know, to your point, yes, you know, seeing Noah's Ark, seeing openly gay black men for the first time in loving relationships, which I'd never seen before, helped me to come out at the age of 24 years old. And of course, you know, Frank Ocean around that time, you know, released Channel Orange, right? And it was a big thing when he acknowledged that a number of those songs had been written to another man. And so it was a huge thing because Frank Ocean was a big deal and, you know, still should be considered a big deal. For that new album.
Still around.
Yeah. So it's a really powerful thing.
I have more questions, but Nando, do you have any questions? I want to give you a chance if you do.
I always kind of wonder like about this because it's such a leap, right? To go from being a private citizen to being a public person. Just what has that process been like for you to sort of take, you know, jump into the ring, so to speak, and all of a sudden you have scrutiny on your life in a way that you just probably didn't have in the past?
I will tell you, I've gotten used to it. Last September, there was an article that came out in City and State whose headline was the gay black Harvard grad running against Nina Lowe. And it was the first time that anyone had written about my sexuality. It wasn't something I was trying to hide from people, but, you know, I wasn't going up in my Baptist church talking about how I was gay, right? It just didn't seem, first of all, not really relevant. And also probably wouldn't go over too well as a topic of conversation in that context. And so I did think to myself, wow, but how are people, you know, people I've never directly had a conversation with about this, how are they going to perceive it? And of course, I wouldn't have it any other way, but there was a slight nervousness there. But of course, everyone supported me anyway, including religious leaders. And so I'm just really, really grateful for this journey. Really grateful for this journey.
And what advice do you have? I mean, I know you said that, you know, you're running to represent your constituents and at the same time, a great byproduct of your candidacy being able to be a voice and inspire people. And you mentioned the disproportionate suicide among the LGBTQ community. So is there anything you want to say to people who are watching or listening?
Yes. Yes. You can do it. You can run. It shouldn't be me and Richie Torres as the first and the last openly gay black people in Congress. If you are queer, if you are a person of color, if you are a young person, if you don't come from money or from a political family in the way that I don't come from money or from a political family, you too can run for local, you know, state or federal office and be successful, even when people are underestimating you, right? Even when local Democratic committees or whatever your party is, even when local political committees are telling you that you have no shot. It starts by stepping out on faith and surrounding yourself with people who are going to give you great advice and be supportive of you and encourage you. And of course, have a good reason to run. And if politics is not your thing, then do something else to help your community. But know that there is a space for you and that you will be accepted. Even when you don't quite fully see it in the beginning, it happens over time, because a huge part of this is showing people that you're serious and that you're the real deal. And oftentimes that's a lonely process in the beginning. But before you know it, you have an entire movement of people behind you.
This is the article, by the way, that you mentioned.
Yeah.
What
are you most afraid of before heading to, like, assuming you do head to Washington? Like, what's the scariest
when you
thing?
Head there?
Yeah, when you head there.
When I head to Washington, I am most afraid of not doing enough to save the world from climate catastrophe.
That's a big one.
I am so worried that people in Washington still don't understand the scale of this crisis and how little time we have left to decarbonize our economy so we can ensure a livable future for our generation and for the people who come after us.
That what distinguishes you from the people you're running against? Today you tweeted that you're for Medicare for All and you mentioned that. Any other policies that you want to point out?
The biggest thing that distinguishes me is that I won the Democratic primary and the other people lost.
That's a good reminder, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, yes, I was the only candidate in a crowded race supporting Medicare for All, which incidentally is what my outgoing member of Congress supports. And so it's wild to me, especially in the midst of a global pandemic where 40 million people lost their health insurance, lost their jobs over the course of a 10-week period, that we would still be, opposed to the one policy that would actually ensure that everyone has health care. And so I'm really grateful for the people of this district, Democrats, for rallying behind me and giving me, I think, a really good margin of victory to show a mandate.
I'm looking for this really great tweet you had that it was like, oh, I know what it was. It was that couple, that scary couple, that scary couple in St. Louis who the husband was just trying to protect his wife, apparently, which is why I guess the wife came out with him. I mean, that's just a minor detail, but if you're trying to protect your wife, leave her in the home. Don't have her come out guns blazing.
It was a total.
Yeah, it was really ridiculous. And I don't know if you saw that this is kind of genius. They had a statement like of solidarity with Black Lives Matter. It was such good damage control.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, they were like, it's long overdue. It was so funny. These are the guys, in case people missed it, they pulled their guns on protesters who were not violent, unarmed, who were on their way, by the way, to protest and demand the resignation of the mayor because she literally doxed her own constituents who wanted to reinvest from police departments. So Mondaire, you tweeted, "Big Pharma when we regulate the cost of prescription drugs next year, and you have the image of that couple. It's a great image.
Absolutely. I mean, we have to get the skyrocketing cost of prescription drugs under control. And one other tidbit of information about these people is that they own a very successful law firm in the area in St. Louis, right? And so that was
part where do you think he buys those pink polos? You don't buy the pink polos without the big law firm money.
And the military style assault weapons, right?
Yeah.
Black people could never get away with this, okay? Like, they would have been shot down instantly.
Well, the funny thing also is that he doesn't even know how to hold it. Like, it's just so pathetic all around. Like, I mean, that's the funniest.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah, he like just no zero training. You know, he has that thing to make himself feel better, but zero, absolutely zero training. It's just so painfully obvious.
How do you, I guess, plan on shaming or moving the Democrats who are not being as progressive as they could be or should be? How do you do that? How do you handle that, walk that line? Because I saw, for instance, the Congressional Black Caucus did endorse you, but they did not endorse another progressive Black candidate who they did not endorse, who won anyway, was Jamal Bowman. And you did get the endorsement. Like, how do you walk that line of working with people, but also
kind of asking them to do better. Like they should have endorsed him and not Elliot Engel.
I didn't think that I would get endorsed.
Right.
It was a few days before the primary. I had started out my race as I mentioned already, challenging the chair of the House Appropriations Committee. So sort of started off my race in the way that Jamal Bowman did in his respective race, one district south of mine in New York's 16th congressional district. And you know, I mean, people in Congress don't like it when you align yourself with people who are willing to challenge incumbents.
Right.
And you know, so there's some tension there, but I think it's really making sure that your colleagues know that you have respect for them, even as you disagree with them. And look, if people are, you know, all districts are different, right? So there are some things that I can talk about that maybe someone in Kansas, somewhere in Kansas, can talk about. I'm grateful to be running in a safely Democratic district. But Katie Porter will tell you, Katie Porter, who flipped the seat from red to blue in Southern California, won her race on Medicare for All.
Right.
And I love that she tells that story. Likewise, in my affluent district, right, Westchester and Rockland County comprise this district, or parts of Westchester, and it is the 19th most affluent congressional district in the U.S. And people were like, "You're just too liberal for this district." Total BS, right? I mean, some of the things anyway that my member of Congress has also stands for, and it was the other people who were more conservative than she was, than she is on these issues. And so, you know, just making sure that we can disagree respectfully, but still like be a person who speaks with moral clarity.
Right.
Independence, right? Like, I don't have a problem pissing off other Democrats.
Okay.
I don't have a problem.
We love to do that on the Katie Halper Show.
Yeah. Feel free to call anyone out or call them in. You call them in too.
You know, but I also recognize that relationships matter. And so I want to have good relationships. But my duty is to the people I'm running to represent. And I will always put them over someone else's ego or desire to rise in leadership.
Yeah. Someone asked if you'd vote to withdraw, if you'd back withdrawing troops from Afghanistan.
Yes, I would.
Yes.
That's the good answer. Oh, we were just talking about that before you came on. Were you cheating on the test, you know?
Oh, great. Yeah. Kyle Kalinske will be your constituent next year.
Okay. Nice. Did you vote for me, Kyle?
Kyle, where are you? I don't know if Kyle's watching. Well, the first problem is Kyle watching? And if not, he's canceled. And then if he didn't vote for you, he's double canceled.
Double canceled.
What about the presidential race? How are you feeling about that?
We have to elect President Joe Biden, right? I mean, there's Donald Trump's reelection bid poses an existential threat to us. He is an existential threat to our national security. He is an existential threat to this economy for families like the one I grew up in. He is an existential threat to everyone's civil rights and civil liberties. And so, you know, to me, the choice is clear. Even as I plan to push him to the left on any number of issues as a member of Congress in January of 2021. But there's no question that we have to elect him.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that like the Dems, it's funny. I was talking about this with someone. I was like, do we have to pretend, like, should people say that they're not going to vote? I know that people are going to say they are, but like, there's no, how are we going to find our leverage?
I think you're already seeing that we have leverage in these unity task force, right? So today, we saw that, members of that panel, I think there were eight members or six members of the panel, including AOC, John Kerry, the leader of the Sunrise Movement organization, release goals that weren't every single thing that progressives wanted, but really did significantly push Joe Biden's policies leftward. And we have to keep doing that because I looked at that and again, it's not perfect. I wasn't thrilled by it, but it is a dramatic improvement upon what he was campaigning on in terms of, I think, 100% clean electricity by 2035, I believe, and I think by 2030, green, you know, all units that are built moving forward would be green and sustainable. So that's exciting. You know, I say that as someone who supports AOC's Green New Deal in public housing.
Right. Did you see Deborah Messing get into it with Nina Turner? I don't know if you saw that.
I saw a little bit of it, but I don't have the full copy.
Okay, yeah, I'll talk about it after.
Don't get him in trouble, Katie.
Come you're on. Right. You're right. I won't. No, Nina Turner. I mean, Nina's great. Nina Turner's great.
No, of course Nina Turner's great.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
Not worth weighing in on a Twitter fight.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, the issue is. I'll just say the issue. You don't have to comment on that. I won't. I'm not. But the subject of the debate was whether or not the black vote is owed to Democrats, and it was an interesting. It was an interesting discussion, but it does feel, yeah. What do you have a sense that some Democrats take that vote for granted?
Absolutely, I do. I absolutely think that Democrats take the support of black people for granted. I think that if they did not take the support of black people for granted, you would see more candidates, including people out who are just running against me, talk about racial justice, specifically policing reform and criminal justice reform, well before the murder of George Floyd and, you know, national unrest.
Right.
Subject, you would see more people support Medicare for All.
Right.
Which, you know, right now we live in a healthcare system that conditions your ability to get necessary medical care on your ability to pay for it, which disproportionately harms black and Hispanic people. We are in an economic system that concentrates 90% of this country's wealth in white communities and only 5% in black and Hispanic communities. And we largely fund our public schools through a property tax-based system that results in the concentration of tens of billions of dollars in white communities and the deprivation of black and brown kids of critical education opportunities. So, but too many Democrats, in fact, most Democrats don't talk about those kinds of issues,
right.
Not on the scale that would actually materially improve the lives of people. And so I do think that we're taken for granted, and I'm fighting to change that. And I'm grateful to be in a district like this and define expectations about who can be successful.
And what do you think should be done about police reform?
We need national standards in policing. People should have to identify themselves and practice de-escalation. That we should have independent offices conducting investigations and prosecuting, if necessary, police officers when there have been killings and other inappropriate actions. We have to make sure that we end qualified immunity. You know, this doctrine that the Supreme Court created and that no one asked for, but that allows police officers to evade responsibility even when it's clear they violate the constitutional rights of civilians. But we have to go well beyond that, right? We have to end mass incarceration as we know it. We have to invest in alternatives to incarceration. Let me go back and say that we need to, talk about defunding the police and you know, cutting that funding and reallocating it to social workers and youth employment. You know, a lot what we're dealing with right now in one part of my district in Peekskill, for example. We need funding for summer youth employment, because we know that these things, again, quality public schools, social workers, healthcare, these are things that we know improve the quality of life of people and improve public safety without requiring the policing of black and brown bodies. But on back to the criminal justice reform piece, again, it's ending. It's ending, eliminating mandatory minimums. It's fully funding the right to counsel. You got too many public defenders who have hundreds, if not thousands, of cases that are preventing them from giving adequate attention to each of the people they represent. You have to make sure that we abolish private prisons, that we legalize cannabis, and that we eliminate all the barriers to reentering society after you have done your time, so to speak. Right. So. Banning the box, for example. Right now, there's a rule that says you can't get federally subsidized housing if you have a conviction, which is total BS, right? These things are meant to send people back to prison and jail.
Yeah. And do you think, it seems like people really like to, and I'm sure, I know you have to go soon. I'll ask my last question. Ananda, do you have one?
No, go ahead. Okay.
It seems like people really do like to present kind of economic justice and racial justice issues as separate and mutually exclusive. And what's your response to that?
I think the racial and class inequality that we see in this country are inextricably linked. This is a government that deprived African Americans for generations. Well, in fact, for most of the existence of the black community in this country, of wealth. You know, whether it's through redlining, through denying employment opportunities. And so, you know, obviously there's poverty in the white community.
Yeah.
But when we look at poverty in the aggregate and other forms of inequality, I mean, these are things that are oftentimes state-sponsored or at least encouraged by states, local governments, and the federal government. And so you can't really address poverty. And let me also say that even, you know, as someone who, there have been studies that show that no matter how wealthy you are, like, you still are going to be discriminated against based on being Black or Hispanic in this country, whether it's job opportunities, even the fragility of wealth, and all the resources that people are sort of oftentimes used to support you, you know, being able to pay for college and getting money from your parents, and getting the money to invest in a home, and of course applying for jobs. Hell, interacting with police officers on the street who don't care how much money you have if you're Black, oftentimes. These are things that are if you are a person of color, you're still going to be discriminated against because of.
And what about, how do we also reach out to poor white voters? I mean, I don't know how much that exists in your district.
It is a district that is 60% non-Hispanic white, about 20% Latinx, about 12% Black, and about 8% Asian Pacific Islander. It is what I describe as a tale of two cities, right? The average household income is about $100,000, but we have pockets of deep poverty, and over 200,000 households in my district are defined as housing burden, meaning they pay more than 30% of their monthly income towards rent.
Wow.
It's running on a message of inclusion. But here's the thing, as Charles Booker also said today, and I wish he had won that primary.
He didn't come on he didn't come on the Katie Alpert show. Sure. I invited him on. Could have been a game changer. He didn't deny me. It just didn't happen. Yeah, he didn't diss me.
People of color and white people alike know that this government has never worked for everybody. It's only ever worked for the super rich and the well-connected.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you start there. Start with the kinds of policies that would improve their lives. I talk about property taxes being too high in my district. I talk about how we need to lift that $10,000 cap on assault deduction. I noticed that Katie Porter talks about that in her in her district as well, which is a similar district to mine. So there are some suburban concerns that maybe other people don't have in different parts of the country. But ultimately, you know, on the big stuff, healthcare for everyone, affordable housing, saving the planet from climate catastrophe, these are things that are largely popular with the American people.
Yeah. And any, in terms of messaging, I feel like maybe this is a Twitter phenomenon, but I do think sometimes the Dems, they don't know, because they run away from class stuff, they don't know how to talk to, and they have their they kind of niche market and offer a lot of lip service, but they don't necessarily do it around class. So I think that there's this narrative that like, you can't talk about class because people are racist, but I think that that's the only way you can, one of the only ways you can mitigate racism is if you talk about class and organize around class so that people who maybe are looking to be part of something, instead of being part of some racist community, they can be part of a community that's a class-based community.
Yeah, you know, you can talk about racial injustice and class inequality and economic oppression at the same time. I think it would be a disservice not to also talk about the need for racial justice. And I've been talking about that, and it's been received well in my district.
Yeah. Great. Any other, anything else you want to make sure people know about you, your campaign? What's next?
Go to MondaireForCongress.com. That's MONDAIRE for Congress.com. Follow me on social media. I'm Mondaire Jones on Twitter.
Yeah.
And Mondaire for Congress on Instagram.
Great, great Twitter account. You guys should definitely follow it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And yeah, we'd love to come back on.
Good luck.
And good luck. Yeah.
Take care.
Thanks. Bye. That was great.
Mondaire Jones, baby.
He's great, right?
Great guy. Seems great.
Seems great. Good policies. I put a link to him.
Very, very self-assured, you know, calm.
Yeah.
you know, took anything, answered every question, you know, didn't like.
I know. I'm really, I need a bad cop on this show to like, oops, to ask questions. I don't know.
Like harder questions?
Yeah, because I like, yeah, it's hard for me to do that. I'm very assertive, but I don't, I'm also kind of conflict averse.
Well, like, know that. The thing is like.
Yeah, I don't know.
What kind of hard question would you ask someone like Mondaire Jones?
I mean, what? Yeah, like, what the hell are we going to do about Biden? How the hell are we going to move him to the left? We don't have. Look, I'm O'Bernie. You know I love you.
Love him.
But I don't know why he gave up his
No, I hear you, but like, that's not something that Mondaire Jones is going to do. Yeah, or not. Right. You know what I mean? Like.
Yeah. Yes. You're right.
Like, that would be having 50 Mondaire Jonesies in Congress would help in that regard, I think. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I just don't see, like, you know, this guy's running for Congress. Yeah. We like want him to be in office. Like, that's, yeah, you know, this sort of journalistic impulse to like be completely devoid of politics is just right. Wrong. You know, like, we want this guy to win, so why would we want to get him in trouble about right. anything?
I need a better cop, not
yeah.
I need
I learned my lesson after I interviewed Bernie, you know, like, oh my God, and I was trying to help him out. Like, I didn't, you know, so yeah, there's no, what are we going to like? I mean, again, like liberal, right. The liberal media, the failing lion, fake news media, their idea of tough questions is something like, you in 2009 were part of like this group that said this thing, like, what do you say about that, you know? And it's like, who cares?
Right.
You know, like, the, you know, people always forget that the question that got Sarah Palin in trouble, remember, like when she started talking about Alaska and all that stuff, was Katie Kirk just asked her, like, what do you read? You know, sometimes these simple questions like are better and tougher, like the sort of doing your research to like catch yeah. him in something.
Yeah, gotcha. You're right. I just always feel weird and conflicted, but you know, I have to own it. That's my thing. I'm obviously, I like,
if we were like interview, if you were interviewing Neera Tanden, you would have a much different tone. You'd be like, you know, but like, you don't want, you know, you, Neera Tanden is your enemy. Like, Mondaire Jones is not your enemy.
No, Mondaire Jones is our representative and an ally.
Right, he's an ally, but yeah, he's not your enemy. Like, there's, so why try to like,
yeah, you're right.
Yeah, someone made a good point, like the type of question they go like, will you call Maduro a brutal dictator? And it's yeah. like, you know what I mean, like, there's just a can't win proposition there.
Yeah, I know, when people were really mad at Bernie for that, I was like, okay,
guys. The Cuba stuff, and you know. No, it's, but like,
people on the left were really mad at Bernie for calling Maduro. He did call him a tyrant, I think, not a dictator. Which, look, not his finest moment, but come on, guys, come on. Like
as if that had anything to do with anything.
Like, Biden's going to, well, we didn't know. Oh my God.
No, Biden is running to the right of, like, he's trying to outflank Trump on the right on Venezuela. Like, he's doing the John Kerry, he's running the John Kerry 2004 campaign, which was like, I'm actually going to send more troops to Iraq. You know what I mean? Like, so. Well,
there's yeah. really exciting news, though. So, yeah, I'm sorry I brought up the Nina Turner thing. It's just so.
That's why I was like, you know, like, don't get him in that. You know, who cares what he thinks about that shit?
That's fat. That's the red line for me. That's the deal breaker.
What's the deal breaker?
Kidding. You know, where you fall in the Deborah messing.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's your purity test.
Exactly. Yeah. I wanted to share this news with people because I think it's very exciting, which is that Joe Biden has enlisted Deborah Messing, Bradley Whitford, and more stars to raise support on Instagram. The celebrities will talk to prominent Democrats for a series called hashtag Team Joe Talks.
Yeah.
With rally public engagement. Did you know about this?
No.
Yeah. So
I don't care about this.
I think it's great news. I think it's hilarious.
Yeah. Brad Deborah Whitford Messing has morphed into his character in Get Out.
I know.
He is that guy.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. It's called Team Joe Talks, and they're going to get out the vote with Deborah Messing.
Right. The hordes of voters are going to come. Like, Deborah Messing told me to vote.
Yeah. I hadn't seen this, trigger warning, but I want to share one other thing with you guys. Hold on. I mean, we all know where Deborah Messing stands because she's a very vocal supporter of Biden. But I wanted to show one other thing, which is that, again, trigger warning, but we should watch it. And it's good to watch this in like safe space with community. So this is her endorsement of Biden. I'm for Biden here. Bye.
I'm for Joe. I'm for Joe Biden because he's a unifier. After South Carolina, we now know that the African-American community, which has always been the heart and soul of the Democratic Party, believes and trusts Joe Biden. I'm for Joe because he has been an ally to the LGBTQ community. He has passed the Violence Against Women Act. He has the respect of the global community, and I cannot think of a more important time than now with this pandemic, having someone who is a leader who can communicate with the world and work together. I'm for Joe because he has been a member of the Democratic Party his entire life. And I'm for Joe because I believe that he can unify and help us win back the Senate and keep the House. Go, Joe.
God, liberals are so gross. I hate them so much. Like the like fetishization of like the black voters is just the most, by like white liberals, is the most disgusting thing. It's so transparent. They don't give shit about black people. It's like if they serve their own purposes, if they play their little role, you know, they're to be exalted. But as soon as one falls out of line, they are to be punished for thought crime. I mean, it's just so disgusting and gross. And like there's this new push. I've noticed it like in the past couple of weeks, especially with like the Jon Stewart coming back into the fray with his movie or whatever. But he's like, I'm going to stop making the argument that, you know, we need to vote for Biden because Trump is bad. I'm going to start making the affirmative case for Biden.
What is it? Let me know when
No, there is none. But what they're trying to say is like, you know, Biden is a man who understands grief. And that's what we need now, you know, in the White House, is to someone who knows how to grieve because of the whatever 100,000 people that have died from coronavirus and all the other stuff. Right. So, you know, so as long as someone can go, it's really bad, you know, like then that's, and it's just like, God, you guys, you libs suck. No one believes you. Like, it's so transparent bullshit, you know?
It's also really dangerous because, like, yeah, he does know grief. He lost his first wife and a child.
But that doesn't mean anything.
Well, it doesn't mean anything, especially if you use that to block Medicare for all.
Exactly. Like, it doesn't mean anything. Like, there's no evidence that suggests that because your wife died, you're a better politician. Like, what does that have anything to do with anything? It's bullshit. It's just pure bullshit is what it is. Like, there's no.
Yeah, it's actually pretty dangerous if you're going to use that to block. It's like using. It's like.
Well, also, it's just disgusting. Like, it's like you're using your wife's death to like do this awful thing. It's just gross.
And he also, by the way, he told a story about how the man who ran into his wife's vehicle was drunk, but he wasn't. He said it like multiple times. And it just wasn't true.
Well, Biden lies all the time about everything. It's not surprising.
Yeah, lying Biden. Has Trump come up with?
Like the best argument that I've heard for voting for Biden, Michael Brooks told me one time, and he was like, you know, on the extremely narrow point of the NLRB appointments, you know, and I was like, I could actually see that. Like, if we believe that a left movement to be viable in this country needs a revitalized labor movement, you know, the Republican Party's assault on the NLRB is just like, it just murders that from even being possible. And like, whereas like a standard awful Dem will at least put people in the NLRB that make it somewhat possible to be but it's so narrow and so small. That's like the only thing that I've seen that I was, cause like the contra argument.
We have to empower. Oh, sorry.
No. We have to empower what?
We have to empower the labor movement to be as terrible as it is and sell out the working class. No, I mean, I jest, but sure. Yeah.
Well, we need a labor movement regardless. Right. So I don't know how to start it from scratch. You know, obviously the one that we got is terrible, but like, I don't know. Like that seems like the opening of the window of opportunity or whatever, like it's just impossible under Trump, obviously. Whereas maybe with Biden, it's more. But like
the Aaron Maté was making that argument last week.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Uh oh. Union membership went down under Obama.
Oh, I have no illusion that like a election of Biden is going to usher in, you know, 30% right. union density. No illusions about that. Yeah. But there's a chance that maybe it'll stop the bleeding slash, you know, maybe allow the sort of burgeoning union militants that militancy that we're seeing in the last couple of years a little space to breathe, you know, because like it won't under another Trump administration. I mean, it's just, again, I'm not like saying yeah, this is something that's like super inspiring or anything like that, right. Because the contra sort of nightmare scenario is that Biden gets in with 50 million people unemployed, and then he oversees like this awful recovery, which just pisses everyone off and leads to like a more violent right-wing backlash than the 2008 crisis. I mean, the 2008 crisis had the worst month of the 2008 crisis had 800,000 jobs lost. We've lost 50 million in the last 2 months.
So crazy, yeah.
It's the scale of the crisis is just unimaginable. Like our brains are too small to process it right now.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, there need to be visuals of that. Not even joking. There really should be.
Yeah, but I didn't even know. Can your brain even process that amount of crisis? It's just, it's hard, you know, like it's really, really hard.
Another comment from Brian Frederick is liberals are now praising Bush and Reagan. Yeah.
There is no analogy in the Western world to the liberal obsession with their enemies. Like the American Democratic Party loves Reagan. Loves. Yeah, but Obama explicitly ran as a new Reagan.
And the Clintons called him out for it, which was funny.
Yeah. They were right about that one.
But I guess the point is that they're not their enemy, right? That's the whole like Thomas Frank, listen, liberal thesis.
No, yes. But like in other countries where there's like an equivalent kind of, you know, center right party and like a center left party, like they hate each other. And always it's like there's just so much more party discipline that like they don't ever say a nice thing about like ever. They are mortal enemies.
Right.
You know, it is unimaginable for like some PSOE guy. That's in Spain, yeah, it's like the equivalent of the Democratic Party in Spain, to praise some Pepe guy, which is like the equivalent of the Republic. It's just unimaginable, like to say, like, you know, Aznar, I didn't agree with him on all this stuff, but he had a good mustache.
I was going to say the same thing. I was just going to say, but it got a good mustache.
There is no analogy in the Western democracies to the Democratic Party's obsession with their rivals. Because you said that they're not actual rivals. No Republicans are ever praising a Democrat.
That's true. Ever. Yeah, they're so total subs, the Dems. Yeah,
if the argument that they're the same, therefore they praise each other, were true, then you'd see Republicans being you know, Clinton. I didn't agree with him, but he did some things that I agree with. I don't know, whatever the fuck the Democrats say about Bush and Reagan.
Yeah, it's true.
They're like, no, Clinton murdered fucking that guy. What's his name? Yeah.
A very effective politician and also effective murderer.
They don't even grant him that he was an effective politician. They say he bumbled his way through it and he lucked into it and
What will the October surprise on Biden be? He already has so many.
It's just who knows? I mean, like maybe some health issue, you know, like.
Oh, you saw Donald Trump challenged him to like a cognitive test or something?
So funny. It's so good. Sorry. So fucking funny.
So funny. It's terrible.
Well, that's like 50% of his appeal. He's funny. I don't know. Like he's pretty funny.
So should we talk about cancel culture?
Sure.
That letter?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Nathan Robinson just wrote a big thing that I haven't read and I probably won't read about like how the letter is awful or whatever. And, you know, there's this new kind of instinct to the new line on cancel culture from like left liberals is something like it doesn't exist. It's fake. And it's if good. It did exist, it's actually good.
Right. You know? More power to it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it's incredibly annoying because it doesn't pass like it's hard to argue against it because it's like, of course there is like, it's like one of those like thing that make you insane where it's like, of course there's like cancel culture and of course people are annoyed by it. Don't gaslight us. And of course, there's like this weird kind of attempt to cancel like art, you know, and that is very annoying and off-putting to people. Like, you know, there was that post that went viral of like, you know, someone wrote a grad student or something wrote a review of The Shining that was like, wow, ooh, The Shining's not hold up well. It's like, what? You know, shut up. Just shut up. No one cares what you think, you know? Right.
We did say we were going to kind of like rewrite, weren't we going to wokeify stories, wokeify movie plots?
Yeah.
Or problematize them?
No, the thing that you do that's funny is you turn the lib kind of insane cancel instinct against them by like outwoking them, you know, right. Outflanking them. You know, like yeah. Joe Biden trying to outflank Trump on the right.
Yeah,
outflank them on the woke. It's like, well, actually,
yeah.
You saying that this is actually ableist slash
right.
whatever.
Right. Yeah.
The letter had the most banal kind of.
I know. It's really, and it's like, if you want to criticize the people or the where it's coming, this is my big problem. It's like, if you want to, oh, we got our next guest on. You guys, I'm so excited about this. You ready for this?
Yeah.
Ali Abu Nima from Electronic Intifada.
Oh.
Hi.
Hi, welcome.
What's up?
I'm good. I didn't know I was going straight on the air, so to speak.
I can throw you off. You want me to push you
down? No, I just wanted to have enough time to tweet that I'm on.
I don't want to be the Jew who pushes you out.
No, no, that's fine. I just have to tweet. I just have to retweet your tweet.
Yeah. No, I do that all the time. So take your time. And this is my co-host, Nando Villa.
How's it going?
Great to meet you.
Pleasure.
All right, done. Retweeted.
Yay. So we were actually just talking about the cancel culture. Sure. And my take is a little different from lots of people because I think that we should
cancel more people.
Well, no, I want to cancel cancelers. I'm all for that. But I do think that the left, I mean, it's interesting because Ali, we had you on Useful Idiots. And one of the issues we spoke about was the way that Facebook was censoring Palestinian journalists and Palestinian civilians and just like deactivating their accounts. And I think that there is a danger in cancellation and a danger in Facebook and Twitter and YouTube being the like arbiters.
Yeah. Have we established that cancellation exists? I mean, I've canceled tons of people. I block them or they're dead to me or whatever it is. But they're still, you know, have their huge platforms. So, I mean, there's no such thing as cancellation. Like, if only we could cancel these people. You know, it's pretty clear J.K. Rowling is whining because she doesn't like being criticized for her transphobic views. But it's like the idea that she's being canceled is so ridiculous. Like when I drive around in my car listening to the BBC World Service or whatever it is, the CBC, anything to avoid NPR, there are literal news bulletins about J.K. Rowling's latest statement on whatever controversy she's right. involved in. Like the idea that she's being canceled or censored is it's just so absurd.
I guess I just think that the way the left should respond to this is by...
Don't go anywhere, because I'm about to play my great interview with the great Chase Abudin. But just a reminder, to hear the rest of my chat with Ali Abu Nima, as well as the debate between Ali Abu Nima and Matt Karp, go to patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again for coming. You have some exciting news. You have a new podcast, but let's first kind of, you know, provide a context for what you're doing, who you are. You are, again, the DA in San Francisco, and you are decarceral, and you're part of this wave of progressive decarceral DAs who probably a couple years ago never thought that they'd step anywhere near a prosecutor's office. So tell us what has most surprised you about what you've been able to do in this role.
Well, you're right, Katie. I was a public defender a couple of years ago, and I was really happy being a public defender. As you know, I grew up visiting my own parents in prison, and the work of being a public defender was work I really enjoyed, being a trial lawyer, advocating on behalf of individuals who were usually in their worst moment in life, in a crisis, and trying to help them navigate that and find a way to a future, to a healthier, safer future, was work that I loved. And now I'm San Francisco's district attorney. It's a real honor. It's humbling to serve the entire city and county of San Francisco. And it's a big job because we're really trying to put the justice back in the criminal justice system. We're trying to make sure that instead of using crime victims as pieces of evidence to secure convictions and send people to prison for lengthy terms, we're actually investing in preventing crime, in healing communities that have been harmed by crime, and in recognizing the full humanity, even of those that we prosecute, so that they can successfully reenter their communities and their families once they've been held accountable. What surprised me the most, I think, you know, I knew that I was in for a big challenge. I knew that the system wouldn't become a truly just system overnight, no matter who was running a particular office. But I nevertheless have been really surprised at how slow it is to implement change. And we've done a lot, and there's so much more that we need to do.
So what are some of the things that you've done?
Well, I was really excited that one of the first things I did, because of my own life experience, was to implement a diversion program for primary caregiver parents. The basic idea, Katie, is we want parents to be at home with their kids, not in jail cells. We are all safer when parents are taking care of their kids. And we're all better off financially when we're investing in families and communities rather than having tax dollars go to county jails and foster parents. So that was the first thing we did. The next thing we did back in January was to prohibit my assistant district attorneys from ever seeking cash bail. We ended cash bail as far as our office is concerned.
Wow. So those are two things that like really actually make a concrete difference, right? In people's
Huge,
lives.
Huge, right? Huge, because you think about how many parents get arrested and how many, then you create this intergenerational cycle of incarceration. So many of the kids that I grew up visiting in the criminal justice system, visiting, you know, our parents together in prison, are now incarcerated themselves. And right. If we could have found a better way to intervene when their parents got arrested, a better way to give their parents the skills and the support and the incentives to really be good parents, we might have broken that cycle. We might have prevented a crime from being committed. And with regard to bail, look, it's, you know, I'm sure many people watching are familiar with how evil and discriminatory it is. But let's just be really clear. Money bail is a system that allows wealthy people to buy their freedom no matter how dangerous they are, while poor people, no matter how low risk, no matter how wrongly accused, languish behind bars and usually forces people to waive their rights and plead guilty, even if they're innocent. Now we have a system in San Francisco, I'm proud to say, that doesn't rely on wealth to determine who's incarcerated, but rather risk. And I'm hoping the rest of the state and country will follow our lead. But that's just what we did in January, Katie. We've been busy since then, too. In response to COVID, we cut the county jail population by nearly 50% so that our jail medical director could create social distancing and quarantine people who test positive coming into the jail. And we did it all in a context where crime is actually falling. So it's pretty amazing to see, you know, people who say, oh, well, if you let these folks out of jail, crime is going to go up. And in fact, what we saw is the opposite, that when we work with San Francisco's pretrial diversion project, when we work with our other reentry partners like the Young Women's Freedom Center, we're actually able to find people who shouldn't have been in jail in the first place. We found a woman with a high risk pregnancy, no criminal history, serving time on a misdemeanor. It's unacceptable. There's no reason in our society where we would possibly say that's in the interest of public safety to put her unborn child in a context where COVID is spreading through jails and prisons across the country. Why would we put someone like that with a high-risk pregnancy behind bars for a misdemeanor? So we're doing better around incarceration rates. And in the wake of George Floyd's murder, we've also taken a number of steps to increase transparency, accountability, and racial justice within our office and with regard to the police department that we work with in San Francisco.
Can you define cash bail just so everyone is on the same page and also define the explain what you mean by pre-trial diversion
for
programs?
Sure. Thanks. Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Katie. So cash bail is a system that's really unique to the United States and the Philippines. Those are the two countries in the world that have a for-profit cash bail system. And basically the way it works in California, for example, it's pretty similar in most places, is let's say you get arrested for burglary. The police take you to jail and they tell the sheriff who runs the county jail, this person was arrested for burglary. And the each county has a list, it's called a schedule, a bail schedule, but it's basically a list of charges on the one side and price tags on the other. So burglary in San Francisco might be $25,000 or it might be $50,000, right? Depending on the county you're in. And if you can pay that $25,000 or $50,000, then you get out of jail immediately. No questions asked. You may have to come back to court to face charges, but you don't need to wait in jail to be brought to court. If you don't have the full amount of money, you can go to a for-profit bail bond company and you can pay them 10% or somewhere around 10%. And they'll keep that money. You'll never get it back, but you'll get out of jail. Now, if you don't have even that 10% or a house or a car that you can give them the title to, then you're stuck in jail until you go to trial or until the judge orders you released. So it's a process that really pins pretrial incarceration of people who are presumed innocent under the Constitution to their wealth rather than to anything correlated to public safety or strength of evidence or prior criminal record or anything else that good public policy would require us to consider. It allows wealthy people to basically never spend a day in jail. And poor people, even if they're never convicted of a crime, often fill our jails. So when I took office in San Francisco, about 80 to 85% of the people in our jail were awaiting trial. They had not yet been convicted. That's the problem we see all across the country. That enough of an explanation?
Yeah, great. Yeah. I hadn't, how long have we had it and how long has the Philippines had it? Do you know?
So,
I mean,
so money bail goes back centuries, actually. What's unique about the United States and the Philippines is that we allow for-profit, basically insurance companies, to offer that sort of 10% payment plan. And then they make a profit off of it. It's a very, very profitable industry. And it's one that transfers wealth from poor Black communities to international insurance companies. In San Francisco, we see that the folks who end up paying these non-refundable premiums almost all come from just a few zip codes. It's mostly Black women. It's mothers, it's girlfriends, it's sisters of young men who get arrested. And again, it's something that actually undermines public safety because it allows people who are really dangerous, you know, your Hollywood sex predator types, for example, to buy their way out of jail without regard to what they're going to do while they're out. And we've seen that in a number of high profile cases recently, while people arrested for shoplifting may languish behind bars, lose their job, lose their housing, lose custody of their kids, all before they've even been charged with a crime.
Mm. And pretrial diversion?
Yeah, pretrial diversion. So the way that works is basically when someone, there's a number of different systems, but when someone's arrested and accused of a low-level crime, a lot of jurisdictions now, instead of formally charging them or formally trying to seek a conviction, allow them to earn a dismissal of the case. And what that looks like depends on the jurisdiction. In San Francisco, for example, if you're arrested and charged with, let's say, you know, getting into a fight with someone in a bar, and it's low level, you don't have a criminal record, nobody's injured. Instead of trying to secure a conviction against you at all costs, we would give you the option of working with our pretrial diversion project, which is a nonprofit that would have you do anger management classes or community service over a period of time. And if you engage with their programming successfully, then the court would dismiss the charges against you. And in fact, we would expunge the arrest from your record, so there'd be no record that you were even arrested. It's a way to incentivize people who are really low level to engage with the kind of programming and services that give back to the community and address the root causes of what led to their arrest without racking up more criminal convictions and jail time.
And can you share a little bit about, you refer to your visiting your parents in jail. Can you explain to people who may not know your story, what your story is.
Yeah, a little bit of background on my family and my upbringing. You know, I was born in New York City in 1980. And when I was about a year old, my biological parents left me at the babysitter and drove off for the day to participate in an armed robbery that had been organized by the Black Liberation Army. Their role was basically to be unarmed getaway car drivers. But the robbery went really badly wrong, and one of the security guards in this armored car was shot and killed. Another one was shot and injured. And then when my parents' car was pulled over, after they had surrendered and were unarmed, the people in the back of the van they were driving came out shooting. Two police officers were killed, and my parents both ended up getting arrested that day. They were tried separately. My father ended up with a 75-year minimum sentence, so he is still incarcerated to this day. David Gilbert, my father, has now done nearly 40 years in prison. He is still incarcerated, and he's not currently eligible for parole until the year 2056. My mother, who did exactly the same thing as my father, just to give one of so many examples of the arbitrariness of our criminal justice system, my mother ended up with a 20-year-to-life sentence, and she served 22 years and was released right around the time I graduated from college. She's been home now nearly, 17 years, and is doing great. But my earliest memories as a child were going into jail, going into prison to visit my parents, waiting in line.
And your father represented himself, right? Is that one of the...
That's right. So my father represented himself, went to trial along with several co-defendants, and they were convicted of every charge. They didn't put on a legal defense. They didn't allow lawyers to be involved in their defense. They were arguing about the Black Liberation Movement and the context in which they had committed this crime as part of a effort to raise money for the Black Liberation Army. And that's what they talked about. They talked about the politics of the crime rather than the facts or the law. So they were convicted of all counts, and the judge gave them the maximum sentence. About a year later, my mother was in the process of picking a jury, was in the final stages of starting her trial, and was able to negotiate a plea deal that resulted in the 20-year-to-life sentence she was given. So all that happened while I was an infant. I didn't really know what was going on, but I do remember visiting my parents during this process, in jail and then in prison. I still visit my father to this day. Of course, COVID makes that very hard, but visited him my whole life. And as a result, I got to see firsthand the failings of our criminal justice system. I saw how we systematically fail to support victims of crime or to invest in healing people who suffer because of crime, while we throw seemingly unlimited amounts of money at punishment and at a system that processes human bodies through cages in a way that's never been done in human history before. The United States leads the world in locking people up. We have 25% of the world's prisoners in this country. And for what? What does that do? Does it make us safer? Does it prevent crime? In fact, it makes us less safe. And, you know, I ran my campaign last year, as you remember, Katie, on a decarceral platform. I wanted to invest more resources in prevention and education and in healing and support for crime victims and in communities. And also in alternatives to incarceration that can hold people accountable through things like restorative justice. What COVID has showed us that I didn't realize, that I didn't appreciate or talk about during my campaign, is that mass incarceration also undermines public safety by making us tremendously vulnerable to epidemics and pandemics. Right.
So you knew, obviously, it undermined public safety in terms of recidivism and in terms of taking away resources from the community. But, right, this is a something that probably, I mean, did not cross a lot of people's minds.
Right. I mean, I spent nearly 40 years of my life visiting jails and prisons. I watched both of my parents navigate the AIDS epidemic while in prison, and seeing friends of theirs and people around them who had very little information about this virus, contracting it, dying of it. Both of my parents did life-saving AIDS education work in their prisons in the late 80s and early 90s. But what we're seeing with COVID is a new and in many ways scarier reminder of something that's much more easy to contract and transmit. And that prisons and jails create the perfect conditions for spreading. You can't socially distance. You can't get access to alcohol-based hand sanitizer. You don't have access. My dad doesn't have access to a shower every day of the week. People have to share a phone with hundreds of other inmates. So all of the things that people in county jails, double and triple bunked, living in dormitories, the churn, what we talk about churn, where people coming in and out every day. In our county jail in San Francisco, for example, we have about 800 staff members, even putting aside the people who are incarcerated there. Just the staff that come in and out every day, go home to their families and communities, and then go into the jail to do their jobs. Sheriff's deputies, civilian staff, Department of Public Health workers, all folks who can bring the disease in or bring it out back to their families. And it's why Cook County Jail in Chicago, for example, Marion Prison in Ohio, San Quentin Prison right here in the Bay Area, have all been epicenters, not just for spread of disease amongst people who are incarcerated, but also for the entire region that they're connected to. People coming in and out of the jail and prison to work and because of arrests and incarceration have all been vectors for the spread of the disease. And it's why in San Francisco, I'm so proud of the fact that we came together and followed the lead of our jail medical director, who said to us early on in March, you must drastically reduce the jail population or people will die unnecessarily. And we did it. We cut the jail population in a matter of weeks by more than a third, from peak to trough, nearly 50%.
What was the process for that?
You know, it required just taking a really close, systematic look at every single person who was in the jail, literally every single human being that's incarcerated, and saying, is there something short of incarceration that can keep the public safe? And in many cases, the answer was yes. People needed drug treatment. They needed housing. They needed reentry planning. I told you, we had a woman who was pregnant and needed somewhere to go and get prenatal care off the streets. Why was she incarcerated in the first place? It required doing that work of not just accepting that jails are a necessary or inevitable response to every single kind of social transgression, but rather saying, no, this is going to be a last resort. And when we did that, we found a lot of people that shouldn't have been in jail.
When was the last time you were able to visit your dad?
The last time I saw him, let me just think. We speak on the phone pretty regularly, almost every week. But the last time I was able to visit him was in late December. I try to visit him a few times a year, but he just got moved to a new prison.
And someone said your dad must be very proud of you. And, you know, it is an interesting... I remember you saying at an event I went for you, and, you know, this was not off the record, so I think it's fair for me to share, right? Plus, I mentioned the last time I interviewed you. But
Uh-oh.
Oh, no, it's not. It's just that I asked you that during this event. I said something, asked you about how your parents responded, and you said one of the hardest things for you was actually telling your dad that you were going to run for the DA's office. I'm wondering if he's, you know, how his view of that has changed. Maybe it hasn't changed.
Yeah, it was a hard conversation for a lot of reasons. And I told you about that, Katie, when we spoke last. I won't repeat the whole story, but I was on a visit with him. This is now in late 2018, November of 2018. And we were catching up and talking about the world and family and all that, as we do on our visits. And then I sort of dropped this bomb on him that, like, hey, I'm getting ready to do something really different with my career. And he had a couple of guesses and didn't guess. And then when I told him,
Was it like social worker or I don't know, professor of...
Yeah, exactly.
Carceral studies or something.
That kind of... He was like, are you going to move back to Latin America? And then I said, no, I'm going to run to be San Francisco's district attorney. And, you know, my dad knows me really well. I think he's proud of me. I'm his only son. He knows my character. He knows my values. So, you know, it's not like he thought I was running so that I could be a tough on crime, punitive prosecutor that was going to send as many people to prison for life as possible. And yet the system is so deeply entrenched. The way it works is so deeply entrenched. It's so hard to change. I think for him in that moment, there was real anxiety and fear, both for me personally in terms of the, you know, what it means to be a public figure, what it means to run for office, and the stress and the and the sacrifices that the whole family has to make when you choose that path. But also, he knows how hard I work, and in many ways, trying to change a system like this one is a process of throwing yourself up against a brick wall over and over again. And so I think he worried about me, what it would do to me. And, you know, here we are 6 months in, and I haven't really been able to see him, but we do talk. And I think, like most parents, he's probably proud. And I think he still probably worries about, you know, that I work too hard and don't make enough time for my wife and family and that kind of thing.
And for him to be released would require a pardon or
a state. It wouldn't even need to be a pardon. Technically, just sort of point of information, a pardon is a process by which a governor or president can say, we're erasing your conviction. Right. You were wrongfully convicted, or for whatever reason,
clemency?
We're going to erase it.
Clemency.
Exactly. Exactly. All he needs is clemency, which would be to convert his 75-year maximum sentence to the 40-year sentence that he served, and then he'd be eligible for parole. The governor, Governor Cuomo, actually granted clemency to one of my dad's co-defendants, Judy Clark, a couple of years ago. She's been released. She's doing really well. Obviously, people like my dad and Judy and my mom, people who have served a really long time, who are old, my dad's in his mid-70s, and who have good prison records, are the lowest risk to release. They have virtually 0% recidivism rate in that category. My dad has a job offer waiting for him if he does get released. So he is someone who the governor could very safely and easily release if there were the political will to do it.
Wow. So what can people do? Are there petitions? We did
actually file a petition, a clemency petition with the governor. The governor is considering it. I don't know what that process looks like. It's not transparent or public. But, you know, we're hopeful that the governor will seriously consider it, and people can certainly, you know, tweet or send letters. It's one of those areas that's totally discretionary. And so it really, you know, the governor of the state has almost total discretion to grant clemency or a pardon to anybody who's been convicted, currently serving time or in the past, in their state. The same way that the president has that power for federal convictions. Or, I mean, really, this is, at the end of the day, the process right now is primarily one of creating political pressure so that the governor feels comfortable doing the right thing. It's a low risk thing for the governor, but obviously the police unions, you know, will continue to push back. They love to see people die in prison, so that's just where we're at. You can email us if you want, but the main thing is if you want to tweet at the governor, send emails or letters to the governor about it, help create that space.
Do you have a hashtag Free David Gilbert?
We haven't been doing a social media campaign yet. At some point we may. We're hoping that we get some feedback from the governor's office, that we hear that they're seriously considering it. And if and when we do, then we would mobilize much more visibly.
Just so that people know, you can probably tell this is not something Chasa came on the show to ask. You know, he didn't ask me to talk about this. It organically came up during this discussion. But is there some kind of unexpected, teachable moment from COVID in terms of finally, it kind of forces the issue of releasing certain prisoners. And as you said, you know, a lot of people were saying, have said, are still saying, you know, if you free these people, you're going to have crime, you know, in the streets. Have you seen it? Do you think this will have a lasting impact? Do you think this is going to be kind of a test case to show people, look, we can release a lot of these prisoners?
Yeah, I hope so, Katie. It's hard. I think it's a little early to tell. And it's one of those things where, and this is, you know, why my campaign was based on a, you know, grassroots movement, the organizing work I've done against the war in Iraq and, you know, other issues, immigration issues, immigrants' rights, have all been based on movement principles and organizing, rather than, you know, some belief that one person or one elected official is going to solve our problems. I'm not someone who's going to sit back and say, oh, we've learned the lesson, therefore, surely everything will be right. I think it's up to all of us. You know, we need to make sure that that's true. No question that we have seen clearly the risks of mass incarceration from a public health standpoint. We have seen in this period the opportunity to decarcerate in ways that do not increase crime. So I'll give you a statistic, just drop a footnote. Since March 16th, which was the date that shelter in place was ordered in San Francisco, until today, crime has dropped by over 33%. That's a huge drop. And meanwhile, we've reduced the jail population by even more. So this notion, as you say, that, oh, well, if you let the people who are in jail really need to be there or else we're all going to suffer, right? That's like what we've been told by police unions and by traditional prosecutors and politicians for decades. We now have empirical demonstrable evidence that that's actually not the case. And if you invest in reentry and if you invest in prevention and communities and supporting folks coming home from jail, actually you can reduce crime by even more. But the question is, will it last, right? That's your question. Will it last? It's really up to us. We need people like me in district attorney's offices. We need people like all of your viewers to hold people like me accountable. And I saw in the live comments, a couple people here are in San Francisco and voted in my election last year. Thank you for your votes. And thank you for being engaged. It's so important at the local level. Even these races where you haven't heard of the candidates, you're not even fully sure what they do. Let me tell you something. Our efforts around police reform, around police accountability, around criminal justice reform, around budget equity, around racial justice, those are issues where, especially with the person we have occupying the White House today, the local elected officials have a tremendous amount of power and a huge, really underappreciated role to play in fixing some of these historic inequities.
And tell us about your new podcast, Chasing Justice.
Yeah, so it's really exciting. I'm new to the podcast world. I've been on your, been interviewed by you before, which is fun. But just a few weeks ago, together with someone in my office, also a former public defender named Rachel Marshall, we launched a podcast that allows us to talk about the issues we're working on in the San Francisco DA's office, but also to bring amazing guests on the show and talk about broader social, political issues, policy issues, and help provide a forum for people who are interested in criminal justice reform and social justice to learn about cutting edge issues. Our first episode had Professor James Forman, who wrote the Pulitzer Prize winning book, Locking Up Our Own, about the role that the black middle class and political class played in the mass incarceration policies of the 80s and 90s. Our second guest was Professor Angela Davis, civil rights icon. And then our most recent guest we had on last week was State's Attorney Kim Fox, who is also a progressive decarceral prosecutor and friend who runs the Cook County, Chicago DA's office. And we're going to have a lot of really exciting guests coming up talking about policy issues in our office and beyond.
And it's called Chasing Justice.
Chasing Justice, exactly. You can get it on iTunes, Stitcher, all that stuff. We've got a website, chasingjustice.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram. Definitely follow us, get involved. And, we'd love to get questions from people and also suggestions for what other guests we should have on. Maybe we should have your very own Katie Halper on one day.
Yeah, I could just be the, lawyers are sometimes very bad. You're not, but lots of times, I've noticed this whenever I'm writing, when I've written about a case, like lawyers are not very good sometimes at writing for non-lawyers. And then what happens is one journalist interprets it and they like get it wrong. And then every other journalist who is not a lawyer, who doesn't understand it, like copies that one misinterpretation. I don't mean like legal theory or philosophy. It's something very, it'll be something very basic. It is a great podcast. And one of the things I heard you say with Angela Davis is you were saying how much you respected her. You're like, we have our political differences. Was wondering what some of those political differences were. And I know you've said about yourself and you said on this episode that you are decarceral, but not abolitionist. So what does that mean?
Well, so that was the main thing in the context of that conversation that I was talking about. And, after I said it, I don't want to spoiler alert for folks who haven't heard the pod yet, but then Angela turns around and says, well, actually, that sounds like you are an abolitionist
to me.
Yeah. So some of it is how you define it. And, we all choose different labels, right? Gender, political, whatever. We all have a right to choose our own labels. Angela is someone who's really been a pioneer in thinking about so many issues, gender equity and criminal justice. But in the context of that conversation, we were talking about her role in advancing the theory of prison abolition. And what I was saying is that I don't identify as a prison abolitionist, but I do believe that my job as a prosecutor, as a elected prosecutor, is to create policies that make our community safer wherever possible without relying on incarceration. And in the long term, ideally, and this I understand is a little pie in the sky, but ideally to organize myself out of a job.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say. Right?
Like,
yeah.
I want to live in a world where we don't need prosecutors or police. That right. may not happen in my lifetime. I'm not naive about the dangers and risks to public safety that exist. And I'm not naive about the failings, systemic failings of our government to invest in healthy communities, healthcare, education, employment, mental illness, all those areas, addiction that we've just allowed to fester and which create the conditions for crime. We need a response to that. And today I am the response in San Francisco. But in the long run, let's start before the problem and prevent the problem from occurring in the first place.
I know you're so busy. I just want to ask you two more questions. If that's okay.
Sure. Sure.
What does defund the police mean to you? What should it mean? And also, your race was so close. And I mean, that's an example. I don't remember the numbers, but it was ridiculously close. What do you think? I mean, it's a combination, I'm sure. But what do you think some of the reasons that you won were, given all the odds that against you?
Yeah. So two big questions.
I know. I'm like, I'll let you go.
Let's talk for an hour about these. No big deal.
NBD. Yeah.
Exactly. So the defund the police movement to me. So again, I think I want to distinguish between defunding and abolition. I think there are some people involved in the defund movement who identify as abolitionists, and there's other people who do not. So for me, when we talk about defunding, I don't think about it as abolition. I think about defunding as how we allocate resources. So I think it's a really simple question, and it's one, ironically, that should appeal to all of the kind of Republicans that claim now disingenuously in many instances to be fiscal conservatives, right? I think it's a question of saying, okay, we have tax dollars that are precious and limited, and we need to choose every year when we do our budget, every year constantly, we need to choose how do we invest those resources? What do we do with our tax dollars? Do we build another hospital? Do we build a better school? Do we give our teachers a raise? Or do we allow our police to militarize and buy tanks, right? I mean, those are like real choices. There's more, of course, but those are real choices that we as elected officials have to make every year when we do our budgets. And the defund the police movement, I take as a demand that local budget-making bodies, the Board of Supervisors or the state legislature or what have you, look seriously at ways to cut police budgets in order to invest. It's really about investment and divestment more than about defunding for me. It's about where can we spend that money. San Francisco, for example, we have about $700 million that goes every year to the police department. For point of comparison, my office's budget is less than $70 million, so less than a tenth of what the police get. And starting salaries for police in San Francisco are more than 50% higher than starting salaries for teachers. So defund is more a question of saying, how do we allocate resources? What do we choose to invest in? And what's going to give us the best return on that investment? And I think there's a wide recognition that much in the way the military-industrial complex at the national level for so many decades led to ever-growing, ballooning military expenditures, and neither Republican nor Democrat felt comfortable critically examining that massive expenditure and saying, well, maybe we can actually be more efficient with this money. The same thing has happened at the local level with policing. The budgets just grow and grow and grow and grow every year without any real accountability for how that money is being spent or what the return on that investment is. Your second question was about the November 2019 DA race when I won. And it was a very close race. So for context, San Francisco uses something called ranked choice voting, which if people are not familiar, is a system that allows every voter to put their first choice, second choice, third choice, and on down as many candidates as exist. And it's confusing to many folks, but the basic premise, I'll give you an example of where it would have made a big difference in American history. Let's say that we use that system at the for presidential elections. And let's say that in 2000, the year that Gore lost to George W., voters in the state of Florida, right, lost, right, but voters in the state of Florida, it, or the election was stolen or decided by the Supreme Court, or, right, but we all know that had a few hundred extra votes in Florida gone to Al Gore, that he would, had they not been stolen, he would have then technically won Florida, which would have given him the whole country, the Electoral College. Many people that year in Florida voted for Ralph Nader, the Green Party candidate. And they did that in broad terms because they didn't like Al Gore and they didn't like George W. But almost all of those people were more aligned with Gore than with Bush. They maybe didn't want to vote for Gore, and they wanted their vote to be a protest vote against their, you know, issues with the Democratic Party or with Al Gore personally as a candidate. But in a ranked choice voting system, everybody could have voted for Ralph Nader as their first choice and then put their second choice as Al Gore. And once Ralph Nader gets eliminated, once he doesn't have enough votes to be in the top two, all of his ballots then get reallocated to the second choice vote on them. It allows, in some ways, a more truly democratic process because it empowers voters to put their real first choice, even if it's a candidate who has no prospect of winning. In our race, the first round of votes, there were four candidates. I was in the lead amongst the four after the first round of voting. And I was about 9,000 votes ahead of the nearest competitor in a race where there was a total of 206,000 votes cast. So a pretty small margin. After the second round, when the first candidate, the least vote-getting candidate had been eliminated, I was still in the lead by about 6,000 or 7,000 votes. And then after the third least vote-getting candidate was eliminated and was down to the top two, I won by about 2,500 votes, or a little over 1% of the remaining votes. So it was a very close race, and it was one that we couldn't have succeeded in but for a tremendous grassroots movement. The energy, the volunteers, the phone banking, the door knocking, all of it was really spectacular. It was in many ways unprecedented for a local race like this. And it's the same movement that got me elected that has fed into and been part of this broader national Black Lives Matter movement and movement demanding police transparency, accountability, and criminal justice reform. And I'm so humbled to have a seat at the table, to be in a position in this critical, pivotal moment in American history to try to implement changes and set examples for other offices and other jurisdictions about some of the concrete things we can do at the local level to really change the game and put the justice back in the system.
And anyone you are endorsing?
Lots of people I'm endorsing, depending on, you know, the race. I'm not sure which one you're looking at.
Let's see, Shahid Buttar?
Haven't endorsed him, but he's a good friend. I'm a big fan of his, really smart guy. I've done a lot of campaigning with him, side by side with him. I have not endorsed in that race, but really excited. If you're not familiar with him, you should check him out. He's challenging Nancy Pelosi from the left. He's really smart, you know, different than your typical, you know, U.S. congressperson, and someone who's, again, like my campaign, running a grassroots campaign, rooted in community, you know, broad, intellectual, hardworking, you know, people's candidate. So he's definitely someone to check out. I'm excited about him. Lawyer. Yeah. Stanford lawyer. Well, you know, got the fancy degree, but didn't let that go to his head.
Right. Like someone else I know. I went to a small law school in Connecticut.
Yeah, exactly.
I gotta ask the question. I don't like doing this. I'm very assertive, but not with my guests, but why not endorse him?
You know, it's just local politics. Right. I mean, it's an option. I mean, I've been out there campaigning with him. I've spoken at his campaign events. Yeah. And matter of fact, get this. The Mojo, you guys are going to laugh, but the Mojo is like right there. So my campaign headquarters, the physical office that we use for our campaign, is now his campaign headquarters. Literally the same office space. So it's, you know, it's all family.
Yeah, yeah. So you haven't endorsed him.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Anything else you want to make sure people know about what's happening? I definitely want to
recommend your podcast. Also, ask Angela if she regrets at all not endorsing Bernie Sanders now that we have Joe Biden as the nominee. Wonder how her cultural feminism racks up to that. Yeah, please. And have, and tell her we would love to have her on the show, the Katie Helmer.
I will.
Yeah.
I will. And you, she was a high school classmate of my mom, Kathy.
Oh, okay.
That's how I know her. So we go way back.
Right. And Chase and I go way back.
Summer camp.
Yeah. Camp Kinderland.
Well, it's great to see you. Yeah, great to see you, Katie.
Great. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Have me back anytime. Keep rabble rousing. Yeah. I want you to keep, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll keep pushing you to endorse Shahid.
Like I said, he's my guy. I had a conversation with him really early before I had even announced my campaign. He was one of the first people I spoke to about my decision to run for DA. So a lot of respect for him. Really excited about what he's been able to accomplish. And you know, people should definitely support him. He's great.
Great. Thank you so much, Jason.
Thank you. Talk to you all soon.
Thanks so much for listening to the Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of my chat with Ali Abu Nima, as well as a very dynamic and spirited debate between Ali Abu Nima and historian Matt Karp, who also happened to sign the letter, go to patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. The Katie Helper Show is edited by Ted Reedy. Our theme song is by the band Cordova.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.